Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Arthur V. Evans. He's an entomologist, educator, photographer, radio broadcaster, and video producer. And we're talking about his really amazing new book, The Lives of Beetles, A Natural History of Coleoptera. Art, welcome back. It's a pleasure to talk to you again.
Well, thank you for having me.
Hey, this is a stunning book. I'm not going to make any bones about it. And I want to mention, it's got an international perspective. How hard was it to put this book together? Because it looks like it was a lot of work.
It was a challenge in just trying to figure out what to leave out.
Oh, God. I can imagine.
There was a limited amount of space.
Yeah, I know.
And the photography was a challenge because, you know, we needed to get really good photographs. I wish I could claim that they were all mine, but they're not. Very few of them are. But we went with photographers all around the world and to assemble this beautiful book. And I think the publishers, Unipress and Princeton University Press, did a marvelous job in putting it all together. They were great to work with.
This is the kind of book I can hand to people and go, how can you not be interested in beetles?
Well, I've always thought that if people had a chance to see beetles like they're presented in the book, they would feel very differently about them. I mean, one of the things that beetles have going against them for the most part is that they're small. And certainly in this part of the world, you know, without a lot of magnification, you can't really see just how incredibly gorgeous they are. And this book, you know, removes that filter and just splashes them across the page and just washes you with these wonderful photos.
You're right that we live in an age of beetles. What does that mean?
Well, from my perspective, it means that beetles are the most speciose group of animals in the world. There are about 400,000 species worldwide, which makes them the largest group of animals. And it just boggles my mind daily that in spite of their ubiquity and diversity, we still know relatively little about them, and there isn't a lot of support out there to learn more.
Well, you know, that came up time and again in subtle ways in this book. For instance, there's an amazing photograph of the South American Titan beetle, which is a huge longhorn-looking beetle. This young kid is holding it.
Right.
And then you read that we know nothing about its biology. I'm stunned at that.
Well, I say we, you know, I've had no firsthand experience with this, but that was one of the beetles that sparked my interest when I was very young. I remember looking at an old issue of National Geographic, 1957, by Paul Zoll, and he was down in the Amazon looking for that beetle, and there was a photograph of a preserved specimen laid out across a cover of another National Geographic, just to give it perspective, and that just fired my imagination. But yes, it's
the size of a small cat.
Yes. Yeah, I think the largest specimens approach 7 inches in length.
Wow.
And that's, you know, from the tip of the mandibles to the tip of the elytra. And it's pretty certain that the larvae are root feeders, you know, but they just haven't, no one's run across them yet, at least for certain.
That's the kind of thing that gets me worried. We have this spectacular species of which we know very little. And that always means it could possibly get wiped out before we even know anything about it.
Well, that's always a possibility. And also, it's in an area that's, you know, fairly remote and dense vegetation. So it's not the easiest thing to tease out in a tropical rainforest.
Now, beetles are incredibly old, too. The dates you have in your book are 322 to 306 million years ago. In other words, the earliest beetles that we know from fossils are from the Carboniferous period. The incredible thing about those fossils that you show in the book is they're recognizable instantaneously as beetles.
Yes. Yes. And there are some weird fossils before that that are sort of intermediaries. You know, they're thought to represent the initial lines from which beetles sprang from. But Beatles sort of came online early on, and that's thought to be one of their reasons for success, the fact that they evolved these thickened forewings or elytra, which simultaneously do all kinds of things for them.
I want to talk about it because there are so many aspects of Beatles that fascinate me, but since I was a kid, I have been fascinated by their wings. And watching a beetle take off was one of my great joys as a young kid. Talk about that. First of all, beetles have an exoskeleton. Talk about that first.
Right. Well, beetles are insects, and insects are related to a much larger group of animals referred to as arthropods. So that includes not only insects, but arachnids and crustaceans, you know, crabs, lobsters, that sort of thing. And arachnids being scorpions, ticks, spiders, and whatnot. And they are all characterized in part by the fact that they have this external skeleton that protects them from all kinds of horrors in the real world. And in the case of beetles, their forewings, their front pair of wings, are modified into elytra. And what that means is that they have thickened forewings that are either soft and leathery, like you have in fireflies or lightning bugs, or hard and shell-like, like you have in, Titanus giganteus, or your June beetle that's buzzing around your porch light right now. And those elytra help protect the beetle's delicate membranous hindwings that are carefully folded underneath. It also protects the contents of the abdomen and all the organs that are contained within. And depending on where the beetle lives, those very same structures adapt it for living in hot, dry deserts or for capturing a bubble of air and living underwater. So it's really an amazing development that they acquired very early in their evolution, and that's thought in part to contribute to their great success and diversity over the millions of years.
But it's amazing watching one take off because those elytra just sort of swing up. They look like a machine when it happens.
I've heard them described as when they're flying, they look like trucks in low gear, you know, just sort of taking off. But yeah, the elytra, depending on the beetle, most beetles will lift and separate their elytra, and through hydrostatic pressure, you know, blood pressure, they unfold their wings and off they go. And the elytra don't flap, they just act as stabilizers. But there are other beetles where the elytra are fused, and they're still capable of flight, and they just sort of lift up in unison, and then the flight wings sort of slip out from the sides, and then off they go. So, they're really amazing structures.
Now, some beetles are flightless, though.
Yes, some beetles are flightless. Either they lack fully developed flight wings, or those hind wings, or they lack them altogether. And in those cases, the elytra are often fused. And we see this time and time again in desert species that are having to grapple with, you know, extreme temperatures and low humidity and lack of available water, that sort of thing.
Here in Massachusetts, beetles have gotten a really negative rap in the last couple of years, mainly because of Asian longhorn, but also now emerald ash borer.
Yeah.
And we need to talk about the fact that those are invasive species.
Yes, these are invasive species from Asia, and they attack living trees that are very important in eastern United States. And in the case of across the United States and Canada, and the larvae will feed on the living trees. And these trees are often important as street trees. There's concern about the Asian longhorn borer getting into situations where it's attacking, sugar maples, and it would impact that industry. And of course, emerald ash borer has been killing ash trees by the millions across northeastern United States. Pardon me. And threatens ash trees across the United States. And there are a number of insects, including some very striking beetles that are dependent on ash trees. And one of those beetles is the Hercules beetles, both the eastern and western species.
I hate to say this, but both beetles, both the emerald ash borer and the Asian longhorn, are really handsome beetles.
Well, they are very attractive. I mean, their appearance belies hides the damage that they do. That's for sure.
I know it's one of those things. Yes, I understand that they're a really bad pest, but they do look cool. I'm a sucker for longhorn beetles. I think that's my favorite group.
I've only encountered Asian longhorn beetles once in my career, and that was in Southern California. I was one of the first people involved in the they're not established there, but adults were collected in Southern California, and I was part of that incident. But here in Richmond, Virginia, emerald ash borer is taking out ash trees at an alarming rate. It's very sad to see.
People should look. There are traps for them all over the state here.
The purple prism traps.
Yep. And people are trying to find out where they are, where they're going to appear next. And people, if you look in a tree and you see these traps hanging down, it's for the emerald ash borer.
Yeah, the color is attractive to the beetles, and there's also a chemical attractant that will attract female beetles. And the insides of these three-sided traps are sticky. So when the beetles fly in, they become trapped on the in the trap itself, and then the traps are regularly checked to see if the beetles are present in the area. Unfortunately, they can't be used as a control measure. They don't attract huge numbers of beetles, but they are a strong indication that beetles are in the area.
Now, there are also, let's talk about some beneficial beetles. There are things called museum beetles, and I find those fascinating. Talk about those.
Well, these are skin beetles in the family Dermestidae, and they are used to clean skeletons, which are then used for display purposes or study purposes. When I was working at the Natural History Museum in Los Angeles, there was a facility in South Central L.A. where they kept these beetles in mass, and they would use them to clean marine mammal skeletons, you know, skeletons of whales and other large mammals that washed up on the beach. And I think I mentioned in the book, you know, this facility was not for the faint-hearted. I mean, the smell was horrific, especially in the summertime. But, you know, there are also relatives of these beetles, too, that are serious museum pests, and they can turn an insect collection into dust in a matter of months. Museum curators and myself, I also keep a collection here at my home, have to be constantly vigilant to make sure that these beetles aren't becoming established in the collection.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Arthur V. Evans. He's an entomologist, educator, photographer, radio broadcaster, video producer, and we're talking about his latest book, and it is a wonderful book, The Lives of Beetles, A Natural History of Coleoptera. Now, you can also eat beetles, some beetles, and actually, not the adult ones, the larva.
Yes.
I've had them in Australia.
What did you have? Did you eat the witchetty grub?
Yes, I did, with peanut sauce.
Really? And how did you find them? You're ahead of me. I have not tried them.
I think they're actually okay. I mean, here's the problem. Okay. I have a high tolerance for odd food. It's the texture that gets people a little bit weirded out.
Yeah.
Because grubs, as you know, are just big, fatty blobs.
Right.
And it's that squishy sense that gets, you know,
But you didn't have them. There was no delicate crunch on the outside.
Well, you hold it by the head. You hold it by the head.
Oh, right. Okay.
And then you sort of bite down on them. But I find that I could eat them. Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, the only thing I've tried is pretty pedestrian in the world of entomophagy, eating insects, and that's mealworms. I've tried other insects and arthropods too, but mealworms are commonly used, and I've eaten a number of things that use mealworm or cricket flour.
That's right. I've had
the primary ingredients.
Back to beetles. Otherwise, we'll go off on a tangent.
Yeah. Okay.
One of the other things I love about beetles, and I have to talk about this because whenever I see an interesting one, are their antenna variety.
Yes.
The antennas of some of the beetles are some of the most amazing things you'll see on a living object.
Well, the antennae are the primary, next to the eyes, of course, are the primary sensory organs of most beetles, and some of them can be quite elaborate. In fact, there are species where that are what we call sexually dimorphic, which means that you can distinguish the males and females by prominent right. physical characteristics. And in many cases, the males have very elaborate antennae. Either they have elaborate structures or they're much longer than those of the female. And this provides more surface area that can be packed with, you know, sensory structures that can detect the presence of the female's pheromone from long distances.
The great thing in this book is there's a whole chart of all the different shapes and variety of antenna. And some of the names for some of the shapes are just things I have not ever come across, like flabellate.
Oh, flabellate, yes, the fan-like
antennae.
Yes, right, that's where the extensions are of different lengths. They're shorter on the ends and longer in the middle. My one I'm partial to is lamellate, which
yeah.
is what all scarab beetles have. You know, the terminal articles of the antennae are referred to, are plate-like, or referred to as lamella. And this is what is the primary makeup of lamellate antennae. And in the case of scarabs, they can fan those out, or they can fold them tightly together in a club. And that's what distinguishes scarabs from all other beetles. So I always thought those were cool.
Is there any sense about why they evolved so many different forms of the antenna?
I suspect it has a lot to do with, you know, how they're making their living and what they need to do in terms of their sensory abilities. A lot of these antennae or elaborate antennal features are thought to be involved with the detection of pheromones that are released by
yep.
the females, these scents, attractive scents that are used to attract mates.
Let's talk about a minute about water beetles, because I find those fascinating too. It's amazing how some of them, like the predaceous water beetle, can breathe essentially underwater. How do they do it?
Well, in the case of predaceous diving beetles, they're air breathing, so they have to go up to the surface of the water and they capture a bubble of air beneath their elytra. There's a space or a gap between the elytra and the abdomen called the subelytral space. And they capture a bubble, hold it in that space, and that brings air directly in contact with their spiracles. These are the openings along the side of their bodies that are connected to an internal system of tubes called trachea. And the oxygen goes in the body that way and reaches every cell in the body. And then the carbon dioxide is expelled through that very system. And once the oxygen is played out in that bubble, they'll return to the surface, capture a fresh bubble, and dive back down, and they can stay down for several minutes.
There's an amazing photograph in your book of a whirligig beetle's eyes.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure anybody who's ever been to a pond or a slow-moving stream has seen these amazing beetles that are floating on the surface of the water, and they're sort of moving about en masse. But their eyes, I knew that they had a split eye. I didn't know it was that dramatic until I saw the photograph in your book.
Well, they're amazing. I mean, all insects, including beetles, have compound eyes, and that means that each eye is made up of multiple lenses. And in the case of whirligig beetles, the compound eyes are completely divided into two parts. The upper portion is above the water line, and the lower portion is below the water line. And each portion of the eye is specifically adapted for seeing in the air and in the water, respectively. How their brain sorts that all out is a mystery to me.
Oh, my God, yeah.
They could talk about that, but not me.
I don't even know if anybody understands that, because they were well separated, yet they're somehow working in unison, because the insects are incredibly successful, and they're able to sort of float on that surface, right, and see below and above. It's incredible.
Well, and that's just the beginning of their adaptations for living on the surface of the water. Their front legs are adapted for grabbing insect prey that's become trapped on the water, and their middle and hind legs are short, broad, and paddle-like. And the tip of their abdomen can dip down almost 90 degrees and act as a rudder. And so that's how they can make all those wild gyrations, and that's why they call them whirligigs. They can turn on a dime. They're just amazing animals, truly are.
They really are. Let's talk about beetle defenses, because there are different beetles that do incredible things. First of all, there are click beetles. And
uh-huh.
as a kid, I used to have a lot of fun finding a click beetle, putting it on its back, and watch it right itself. How do they click like that?
Well, there's a on their forebody, there's a spine that doesn't quite fit into a groove on a part of their thorax. And when they are on their backs, they're pushing their forebody forward, and eventually that spine snaps into place, and the release of energy is what flips them into the air, and with an audible click, hence the name click beetle. And the idea is that they can do this and slip out of harm's way, and it might take them one or two clicks in order to land on their feet, and then off they go.
I'll have to say that one of the most spectacular beetles here locally is the eyed click beetle. That's a handsome and large specimen.
Yeah, they're very conspicuous, and you know, for years it was thought that those eyes deterred predators, and thinking that maybe this is a much more formidable animal than they want to tangle with. But the truth is that hypothesis has never been tested,
yeah.
And so it would be interesting to see what their actual predators are perceiving when they see these false eyes on their backs.
Now, of the many things I learned in your book, is that there's a weevil that can play dead.
There are many weevils that can play dead. And others.
There's a great photograph, a full-page photograph in your book of a death-feigning weevil.
Yes, it looks like it's something out of a Gary Larson cartoon. You know, the legs are all stiff, and it's lying there on its side. Yes, the heartbreak of thanatosis. You know, we need a 25-cent word to describe playing possum or playing dead, and thanatosis is it. There are a number of beetles that engage in that behavior, and it's thought that, just the fact that they stop moving makes them less interesting to a predator that's looking for something that's very much alive and fresh, and, if something is it won't move at all, regardless of how it's being poked or prodded, chances are they'll just move on.
Now, a lot of them have a lot of species have chemical defenses like stink bugs, which get into everybody's house around here.
Well, the stink bug I think you're talking about is actually a bug. It's a true bug, and that's another.
Okay, that's a different group from the beetles.
Species.
Yeah.
Right, but if you get in the southwestern United States, and there's a group of darkling beetles called, some people call them stink beetles, or pinacate, or clown beetles, and they're known for, when they're threatened, they will stand on their heads, and they release an oily fluid from the tip of their abdomen, and it will stain the fingers, and it has a very strong odor, and a little of that goes a long way. And if you've ever smelled one, you can imagine why an animal wouldn't consider that a very tasty meal.
Well, there's even ones that carry it further. They can eject quite a distance. Bombardier beetles.
Bombardier beetles, yes, they have separate chambers in their body and that carry two different chemicals. And when threatened, they will inject those chemicals into a common chamber, which creates this chemical synergy. And this boiling hot cloud of gas literally explodes out of their anus. And just to make it even more interesting, they have what we call an anal turret. They're able to aim this explosive gas at their attacker. It's not just some random explosion. And I just grabbed one the other day by mistake. I thought it was another species of ground beetle. There are ground beetles that resemble bombardier beetles in color, and that's what I thought I was picking up. And all of a sudden, this thing started chattering, and I could feel the heat on my fingers. And I'm looking at my thumbnail now, and it's still got a. It looks like a burn. It doesn't hurt at all, but there's a stain on my fingernail when this thing got me.
And I never knew this. There's a venomous longhorn beetle.
Yes, this is very unusual. A South American species of longhorn beetle that has not only a spine on the tip of its antenna, but there are grooves in that spine that at least superficially resemble the sting of a scorpion. And these beetles are apparently rare in nature, or I should say rarely collected. And so there hasn't been an opportunity to study in detail the actual stinging mechanism or to determine whether the venom that it produces is drawn directly from its food plant as a larva or if it's something that's synthesized in its body. We just don't know that much about it. But there's an article that appears in a scientific journal that shows someone who was tapped on the knuckle by one of these, and you can clearly see that their finger is swollen.
Wow. Now, I have pages left of questions. We could talk about this book. There's so many things going on with beetles. But I want to talk about the problems of extinction and beetles. Habitat and loss and fragmentation is going to be a huge driver of extinction.
Yes. And that's the case with all species, is habitat loss. I mean, habitat loss is the number one reason for species extinction, and that includes beetles as well. And habitat is lost constantly for commercial development, residential development, and industrial development. The use of pesticides, all kinds, is, and not just in agricultural fields. I mean, this is home use as well. And another reason that we're coming to grapple with in terms of negative impacts on beetles and other insects is light pollution. You know, people that run their lights, you know, 24/7 or run them all night long, that attract unusually large numbers of beetles and other insects that are exposed to predators and injury and that kind of thing. All of these things contribute to an overall decline of beetles and other insects.
The interesting thing about beetles is there's also commercial exploitation. And there's this weird thing, mushi, in Japan, where it's a fad to own these things, these large, interesting-looking beetles.
Yeah, in Japan, beetles are very popular, and there are stores dedicated to selling live beetles and kits for rearing beetles. People do this all around the world. We have this going on here in the United States, but it just isn't as popular and as upfront as it is in Japan. But yeah, there's a huge market for large beetles, horn beetles from all around the world by hobbyists.
We're completely out of time, and there's so much more you could talk about in this book. My returning guest tonight is Arthur V. Evans, entomologist, educator, photographer, radio broadcaster, and video producer. And we're talking about his book, The Lives of Beetles, A Natural History of Coleoptera. I guarantee you picked up this book. The photography is beautiful. The writing is engaging. You'll fall in love with beetles too. Arthur, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your interest.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.